Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I am O'Brien McMahon, and this is People Business. In this episode, I'm joined by Brad Karsh. Brad is the founder and CEO of JB Training Solutions. An accomplished public speaker and executive coach, Brad has been featured on CNN, CNBC, and Dr. Phil, and has been quoted in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Fortune, USA Today, and many, many others. Brad is also the author of three business books, including the critically acclaimed Manager 3.0, A Millennial's Guide to Rewriting the Rules of Management. Brad presents annually at the SHRM National Conference and was ranked number one out of more than 200 speakers there. And that is really what we unpack in this episode. We talk about what it means to be a strong communicator, what it means to have presence, what it means to bring your best self forward, and how to take data, boring old presentations, and really shoot some life into them, really make them meaningful, tangible, touchable for people who are listening. And Brad is an absolute expert at this. This was a masterclass in how to do this. And I would encourage anybody who has to give any kind of presentations as part of their role, which is just about all of us, to listen to this. There is just a ton in here. I want to go back, listen to it again. I want to have my whole team listen to this at work. Really, really impressed by Brad and what he was able to bring to this episode. So hope you enjoy it. If you like anything in here and you want to connect with Brad, he tells you at the end how to do that. You can also see down in the show notes. And if you want to engage with me on this topic or any other topic that we talk about in this show, as always, you can reach out to me through LinkedIn, send me a direct message there, and I will respond and always love engaging in this or any other topic that we cover here on People Business. Here is Brad Karsh. Brad, welcome to the show. Very excited to have you in. I don't know if I've told you this, but you were on the original list that I put together when I was brainstorming this podcast 3.5 years ago now. And I know we've had some folks from JB on before, but it's nice to have the man himself here with us. So welcome.
Yeah, I'm absolutely delighted to be here. Thank you so much, O'Brien. And I think it's going to be a ton of fun. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. And it's every time we connect is exciting for me. You've heard this story ad nauseum before, but your wife was actually the first person to interview me when I came out of school and moved to Chicago, which is coincidentally not how we know each other, but was a fun tie-in, a small world moment that we figured out a number of years ago. So it's always kind of a fun nostalgia moment for me too.
Yeah, it's a long time Karsh connection I see, and I don't know if that worked out or not for you and Leo Burnett, but you seem to do just fine on your own.
It did not, but like many experiences in my life that were original failures, they turned into long-term successes in other ways. They opened the door for other successes. So
there you go.
I actually still, behind my college diploma, have in the frame two rejection letters from the University of Virginia where I had really wanted to go to school. I had my heart set on it, so much so that when I got rejected the first time, I drove down and sat in the dean's office until he would meet with me. And they reopened my case and still rejected me. But I wound up going to Miami of Ohio and had a blast and have some lifelong friends there. And it was the blessing in disguise. So it's always a good reminder.
Good for you.
But that's not what we're here to talk about. So let's jump in. Let's just like start at the beginning, sort of set the table a little bit. JB Training Solutions is the company that you founded. You mentioned Leo Burnett already. How did you go from advertising to running a training and development company? What is that kind of origin story? Why were you drawn to that kind of work?
Yeah, it's interesting, O'Brien, because it was a circuitous journey. And interestingly, one of the classes I teach some young folks is how to think about your career. And I often say that it is a long and winding road. And if you talk to pretty much anybody, what they started doing and what they're doing now could be two very different things. So I started out, I worked for a couple of years in the media department at Leo Burnett. That's now known as Starcom. Some people probably have heard of that.
Sure.
After a couple of years in media, which I really liked, I thought, maybe I'll give a try to client service or account management. So I pivoted my career, spent about 8 years in account management, enjoyed that as well. But my true passion was in people. And believe it or not, you mentioned that my wife recruited you at Leo Burnett. the job that she took as recruiter replaced me. So I actually moved from account management into HR because I was incredibly and deeply passionate about hiring great people, training great people. And that's where I really found what I love to do. So I did that for 5 years, absolutely adored it. And then after I'd spent about 15 years, LibreNet went through some changes. It was privately held and then it became public. I thought, you know what, maybe it's time for me. So I left, and because of my passion for recruiting and working with college students, because we hired a lot of new folks right out of school, I actually first started going to college campuses, including Miami of Ohio, talking to students about resume writing, interviewing, and kind of how to get their first job. I had a little side business that I was doing for some colleges, but also for some companies, on how to make that change, that adjustment, that pivot from student to professional, a program we called The Right Start, everything that you wish you knew before you started working. And as I did a little bit of that for companies.
That's valuable. Yeah.
It's really valuable because what happened, the genesis was, as the recruiting guy, I got to obviously know all the people that we hired. We would recruit at these great schools and people would come up to me 6 months into their career and say, Brad, you know, I was Phi Beta Kappa at Princeton, captain of the lacrosse team. I'm student government. I succeeded in everything I've ever done in my entire life, but I'm struggling here. You know, I'm going to meetings. I have no idea what people are talking about. I'm working 12 hours a day and my boss says I'm not getting enough done. I'm not necessarily getting along with the people I work with. What's going on? And I realized that there are all these things, unwritten rules. And in many ways, the way you learn and act and operate and succeed as a student is just the opposite of what you're supposed to be doing in the working world. So I started doing that program, and 2 or 3 years into this, I'd done that a few times. And one of the companies I worked with said, hey, Brad, you know, we love this program you do for interns and new hires, but do you do anything on communication skills for everybody in the organization? And as any entrepreneur who's beginning their business will tell you, the answer to that is always.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
100%.
Kidding me?
That's our specialty.
Practically our specialty. Yeah. We do that all the time. So I did a little communication skills workshop. And then 6 months later, another client, hey, what about management skills? Do you do any of that? We're like, yes, sirree. Management skills are us. So I started to build up that corporate side of the business, the training, learning, and development stuff. And I actually realized that, well, I love going to college campuses. It was a better business model to kind of work in corporate America. So that's sort of what sparked or spawned JB Training Solutions.
And one of the things that I've always been impressed by with you is your ability to command attention. Is that something that you have worked on? Was it just a natural byproduct of these one-on-one conversations that turned into training? Or was there some focused effort that you said, like, I got to build these skills for myself?
Yeah, you know, interesting. Growing up, I was incredibly and deeply shy. You know, my mom to this day still is astounded at my profession, given that I used to hate any and all of that stuff. But as I got into college and when I started Leo Burnett, I realized that I didn't mind speaking. So I did a little bit more of it. And ultimately, it was a skill that I really wanted to work on and focus on. And like any other skill in life, it takes practice. Yeah. So when I first started doing it, I wasn't, I don't think, as good as maybe I might be now. Like, I've definitely improved over the years, but it is something that was truly a focus of mine in terms of improving and trying to master that skill. I don't think you ever get perfect at it, but I'm sure you've read or know about Outliers, where Malcolm Gladwell said you have to spend 10,000 hours doing something. And at one point I thought, you know, I've given 100 presentations for 20 years between 1 and 8 hours. I think I've done my 10,000 hours. So it is something that I'm continually working on.
Yeah. Well, one of the themes that has come up in this podcast so many times is the value of what I call getting your reps in. And I was interviewing, it really stood out. I was interviewing two gentlemen who were West Point grads and went on to become Green Berets. And they were just talking about what a great leadership institution West Point is. We started to unpack it, and they they explain how from day one, you are put in leadership positions and you are directed, your attention is directed to leaders and what makes good leaders and bad leaders. And you're called out immediately for doing anything that is bad leadership and redirected towards good leadership. And so by the time you walk out of that place 4 years later, the amount of reps that you have in real leadership with real world implications is just like way ahead of anybody else your age. I mean, and even far beyond your age. And so whether you call it 10,000 hours, whether it's getting your reps and whatever it is, I think practice is so important in any skill. And then another thing, another belief of mine is that any behavior that we have is a skill. I think we think so many things are innate, but it really came clear for me when our first son was born and somebody gifted us a book on sleep training. And I originally was like, sleep training? Like, how do you like, we sleep? It's a human thing. Why do you have to train anybody to? And I had two guy friends recommend the same book, and they were like, just trust us, this will save your life. And we followed that book, and it worked. And we trained our son, now both of our sons, to sleep. And I was like, man, if you can train somebody to sleep, like, that just shows you that everything is a skill that can be improved.
Everything is a skill.
Yeah. So what was the process for you as you wanted to get better at that? How did you think about it? What types of things did you do to improve your ability to speak? What was your thought process?
Sure. So the thought was, you know, there's a variety of different ways that you speak, right? We're doing a podcast right now, and that's an element of speaking. I might be standing up in front of a room of 1,000 people. I might be around a small conference table speaking for 3 hours to just 6 people. So what I started to realize and tease out and learn is that there are different methods and different styles or different, if you will, vehicles in terms of how you present. So there are some themes that run consistent across all of those. But I thought, hey, the way that I present in front of 1,000 people is going to be different than 8. And it, to me, it's all about being authentic, being yourself. And what I call, and this is my best piece of advice for anyone, is becoming the best possible you. I think the transformation that I made was when I felt like the version of me presenting was the same version of me. Let's say if I'm talking to a bunch of my buddies. And for some reason, there's this phenomenon when we present that people feel like they need to be stiff, formal, and boring. It's like, well, I'm presenting, and especially to senior people, and they want to be bored out of their mind when I'm presenting. You know, I teach a ton of classes. I've coached literally over 2,500 people on how to present effectively. And I have a small group class with 8 folks. It's a full-day workshop. It's tons of fun. And one of the things we do is that everybody stands up and gives 5 minutes of a presentation to the rest of the group. We film it, and then, you know, I have a one-on-one with them talking about their content. But anyway, I say, hey, listen, before you start your presentation, give us 5 seconds of background, because not everyone in the room knows each other. So this happens, O'Brien, you can't imagine how many times this happens. People stand up and say, oh, okay, this was a really cool presentation I gave 3 weeks ago to senior management, and they just loved it. And I said, great, you can start. Hello, my name is Brad Karsh, and I couldn't be more excited to present to you fiscal 2024. I was like, wait. What happened to that authentic, that real, that genuine person? That's who I want to hear. I call it the best possible you. And here's how you channel it, by the way, if you're looking for some advice.
Yeah.
I always say, imagine, think, O'Brien, about the last time you went out to dinner, you know, with your wife, you're out with maybe 2 other couples, you're at a nice restaurant, Saturday night, 8 o'clock, probably kind of loud in the restaurant, right? So if you're speaking, you maybe have to elevate your voice a little bit. And let's say that you're telling your friends about something really cool that happened to you at work. What would your face look like? Smile and be animated. You might be using your hands a little bit like I am right now. And let's just say you had 2 glasses of wine. That, O'Brien, is the best possible you.
There's the key.
Please, if you're listening to this podcast, please do not write down that Brad suggests that I have 2 glasses of wine every time I present. But what I'm saying is that's the version of you I want to see?
Yeah.
And it took me a long time to figure that out. And it took a lot of work and a lot of practice. But that authentic, genuine, best possible you is what you're trying to channel every time you speak.
So I have a couple questions about this because I agree, but I've had some conversations with people around this that kind of struggle to understand what that best possible you looks like. Because some people, they're like, well, I'm out at a restaurant, two drinks in, there's all kinds of profanity coming out of my mouth. Okay, I'm animated, I'm smiling, my voice is up, but you know, I don't know that I necessarily want to bring that person into the boardroom. So how do you balance that best possible you with that authentic you? Like, how do you hone in on what that really is for somebody?
But yeah, and that's a fair point. So maybe it's one glass of wine, O'Brien. It depends on the person and your tolerance. But what I'm saying is, it is the most animated, the most interesting, the most engaged, the most passionate version of you. Here's the thing. We feed off the passion of the people who are speaking. And if I'm not excited when I'm talking to you, you're not going to be excited listening to me. And I'm not going to like your idea no matter what it is. Right? Now, you don't have to be me. You don't have to be Tony Robbins. You don't have to be pick your favorite presenter in the world. And you hit on something, O'Brien, that's really important. Genuine and authentic to you, right? So you're pulling the best you out. Most people give us the worst you. So one great tip that I give, record yourself. Record yourself presenting. That's the beauty of Zoom. That's the beauty of, you know, a camera on your phone. Record yourself and watch it and think, is this me out with my friends on a Saturday night? Or is this sound like a guy who's reading a very dry research paper?
Yeah.
And here's the other phenomenon, O'Brien, that's fascinating. Again, work with tons and tons of people. And I might have somebody who I know is an engaging person, but when they get up there, they get kind of stiff and formal and boring. And then in this class that we do or my one-on-one work, they present again in the afternoon. So when I have my one-on-one with them, I say, hey, you know, you are here, right? I want you to get up to here, right? Anything above that is going to be over the top, or, you know, people always worry, like, what if I'm too much, Brad? What if I just do this too much? And I say, all right, you're here. I need you to go here. Just push yourself. It's just us. It's just the class. Have fun with it. So they go back. They present the second time. And they're like, all right, what do you think, Brad? Did I go overboard? I'm like, you were here. You needed to go here. You went to here.
Yeah. You went even halfway.
Not even like a tenth of the way. It takes effort. You have to be intentional about it because our tendency is to kind of settle down. And people say, well, Brad, I don't know if my audience, like, they're senior. I work with a large pharmaceutical company with 45,000 employees. And I work with a senior director, associate VP level. So there's probably about, let's call it 500-600 people at that company, more senior than them, but then they're pretty senior. And they say, but Brad, you know, when I present to executives, they don't want that. And I said, you know, to 44,000, you know, 995 people, you're senior. Do you want to be bored out of your mind when someone presents to you? They're like, no. Would you like someone to present in an engaging, enthusiastic, passionate way? They're like, yes. I'm like, I know this sounds weird. The people that you're presenting to are actual human beings. I know. It's weird. They're not robots and they don't think, I can't wait to sit down and hear an incredibly and deeply boring presentation.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's such a mistake that people make, right? Is like that somehow people who have elevated to the executive level have somehow like become a different version of human being where it's all numbers and it's all dry and they're not going home and doing all the same things that we all do when we go home at night as human beings. You know, it's like, I remember that was very freeing for me because I started in my job when I was 25 selling to executives.
Yeah.
And I remember being in a meeting and just, I don't know what it was. It wasn't a knock on the person either, but I just remember being like, oh, they don't know the answer either. Like, they're just doing the best that they can with the information they have. And that's what we're all doing. And they have some more experience and they have more perspective. So they've got good opinions, but they're just doing the best they can with what they have, just like we are.
Yeah.
You mentioned different styles for different scenarios. And I would love to just unpack that a little bit. I think being the best of you is probably a good baseline, no matter who you're talking to, whether we're here on a podcast or you're in a boardroom or you're out in front of 1,000 people. What are just one or two little nuances in some of those different, like if you're going to stand up in front of your team or your company and say something versus your small team and say something versus having a one-on-one conversation, what are some of the pivots that people might want to consider?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when you're presenting big, so let's say it's a town hall meeting, let's say you're presenting on a stage or, you know, 100 people in the audience kind of thing, you go big, right? Your gestures are bigger in terms of what you're talking about. It is more of a performance, or there are more elements of a performance in that best possible version of yourself. When you're sitting around a conference room table, maybe speaking to 6 or 8 people, I have small things that I like. I like to stand when I present. And there are a couple reasons I like to do that. One, where do you think I have more respect, authority, confidence? If I'm sitting or if I'm standing?
Yeah, right? 100%
standing. 100%
standing.
I'm standing right now, as you may be able to tell. Why? Because I have more energy. I have more engagement. I feel like I'm more my game. So whether I'm presenting remotely or in person, small groups, I do like to stand. And people say, oh, Brad, you know, our meetings are so informal. That would seem really formal. And what I say to them, because I'm giving a presentation kind of like I'm talking to you right now, O'Brien, I'll say, yep, do I seem formal right now? And they're like, no. I'm like, that's right. And I'm standing. The reason I'm not, don't sound formal is because I'm not saying, hello, pursuant to our previous agreement, I'd like, if you present authentically, genuinely, casually, you can stand and do that. And then if I'm sitting down or it's just a one-on-one, I'm focused a lot on eye contact. I'm making sure, again, I'm not going to have big, huge gestures out there. I'm not going to go as over the top, but I always want to have a smile on my face. I always want to look engaged and interested. And again, one of the fun things that we do is when I'm watching people's video with them, just in a one-on-one, sometimes we'll be about halfway through and I turn the volume off completely. You can't hear what they're saying. You just see their body language and their face.
Yeah.
And I say, forget about what you were actually saying. What does it look like you're saying right now? And people say, oh my gosh, I look sad and angry. And I look like I'm telling someone their cat just died. I'm like, that's right. And you're talking about this cool new idea you have for 2024, right?
Yeah.
Smile on your face, engage. If I'm not excited, you're not excited.
That's good. And what I hear you saying too is the more you come down in size of audience, the more you want them to feel your presence.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that fair?
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah. And I remember even hearing about like Bill Clinton and, you know, back in his heyday, what made him so charismatic, one of the things was that no matter how big the room was, when you asked him a question, he would turn his attention to you and there was this like presence, like you were the only two people having a conversation.
Yeah. Cool.
And I think that's a good lesson for all of us to be practicing.
For sure.
One other thing that triggered for me in there was you started to give the sort of corporate speak answer, their presentation. And I've had some people on here before talking about language. And it's always a conversation I'm fascinated in. I might bore other people, but I think it's really interesting. And I think it's really impactful, the words that we use. When we talk about being our best authentic self, how do you think about the use of language? Because there's another perception there, right? That we get into a boardroom and we start having to use different words than we use when we're out at dinner.
Yeah. You know, one of the biggest mistakes that I see people make is that when they present one-on-one, all the way up to a huge presentation, is they become far too assumptive about what they're talking about. And they speak in concepts, theories, thoughts, as opposed to real, tangible things that we can touch and feel and hold. Think about it. Anytime you're presenting to someone, you might be presenting what your organization does. You might be trying to sell an idea to a leader. You know exactly what you want to say, right? You're giving a presentation that's showing the results of what you've just done for research over the last 6 weeks. You've lived that research. You've died that research. You've built that presentation. You lived it and you died it. Your audience typically is hearing it for the very first time. And we speak way too conceptually. Think about how, I have a 14-year-old son. I think, how would I explain it to my 14-year-old son? And I'll give you an example of that because I don't want to talk too much in concept, thought, and theory. I was working with somebody once, worked at an ad agency many years ago. And this woman was the senior vice president in charge of all of media research. And the presentation we were working on was something she was delivering for all the new hires, kind of a media research 101. Now, sitting in the audience when she presents are going to be a bunch of people who may not literally know anything about media research. So she starts the presentation out and says, okay, the media research department is divided into two categories. We have the proprietary research group and the syndicated research group. And then she went to go and talk about it. And I said, wait, hold on a second. You know,
what the hell does that mean?
I don't know if the people in the room are going to know the difference between proprietary and syndicated research. And she's like, oh my gosh, you're right. I've lived this 20 years. It's obvious to me. I said, start over. She said, we're divided into two groups, the primary research group and the secondary research group. And I said, hold on. Oh my gosh, you're right. That's more jargon. We have the qualitative research group and the quantitative. And I said, stop. What can we touch? What can we feel? What can we hold? Knowing your audience. Now, if she was standing in front of the International Associate of Media Research Directors, she wouldn't have to do this. But to knowing your audience is key. To a group of new hires, what she finally got down to is, hey, have you ever heard of a focus group? You know, you get 10 people in a room and they kind of talk about Keebler crackers for an hour. We do a lot of those where we kind of plan that research ourselves. We're sitting behind that creepy looking mirror over in the side of the room, which is really a two-way mirror, one-way mirror. And we'll talk to 50 or 60 people in a few different cities, really in depth. We do that research on our own. That's proprietary or primary or qualitative research. So we do some of that. And then remember when you were a kid growing up and you had a landline and the phone would ring invariably at 6 o'clock at night, right when you're eating dinner. And someone on the other end would say, hi, I'm conducting a national survey to see what you think of Keebler cracker products. And your mom would say, go to hell and hang up the phone. All right, that's, believe it or not, people answer those. And instead of like the 50 or 60 people we're talking to thousands of people, short amount of time. We don't do that, other companies do. So that's secondary or quantitative or, you know, that type of research, right? Syndicated research. We buy that. That's how we're divided. Now, it wasn't until she drilled down literally four levels that I knew the people in the audience were going to understand what she was saying.
Yeah. Well, you know, I would be one of those people in the audience and it was easy for me, right? I was going through it and I was like, yeah, I don't know what this means. And then all of a sudden it was like, oh yeah, that's really clear. And I, it's like, oh yeah, I remember that. I think that's the other thing too is, even if somebody's heard it before, that doesn't mean that they know what you're talking about in the moment. And I always think even people who are the senior vice president of whatever, you still don't want to assume that they know. You can kind of check in and say like, hey, are we familiar? Like, I just want to throw a couple terms out, like syndicated, primary, secondary. Like, are we familiar with these terms or do we need to kind of level set here? And oftentimes you get senior people who go like, can you just give me a refresher on that? So yeah, I think never assume. And I always say it like, how would I explain this to a fifth grader? That's what I think.
Yeah, which exactly.
Your 14-year-old is a little past that, but same concept.
But you're exactly right. That's exact. I mean, I have those conversations. This is, you know, a little, maybe too much information. Whenever I'm talking to, once a year, we have to figure out what our health insurance plan is going to be. And I'm the person who sometimes does that. And I'm talking, they're like, well, you're out of pocket max. And then you're, you know, office. And I was like, wait, pretend I'm 10 years old. I just broke my leg. I go into the doctor, right? What is the copay? What is the out-of-pocket? What is the deductible? What are these terms mean? What does this all mean? And I make them describe it to me that way because honestly, I think about that once a year.
Yeah.
These people live that every single day of their lives.
Well, I mean, you know me, that's the work I do. And we help companies figure that stuff out. And I always am reminding our teams who are really in the weeds to do exactly that. Like we got to really pull back up to a higher level on this stuff. And I had the blessing that I started early not knowing anything and was thrust into conversations where I was presenting to executives. And so I remember crafting presentations and I would sit there, you know, like a year to 3 or 4 years in and be like, if I don't understand this, I've lived this enough, but if I still don't understand this, they're not going to understand this. And I try to, as much as I can, remember what that felt like now that I've been there 15 years and try to say like, okay, what would my 2 year in self think of this presentation? You can always simplify and find better language. One other thing is you're kind of leading me along here. You're a great guest. You're leading me right where I wanted to go. In your example there, you demonstrated or you made your point by telling a story. And then even within the story, it got really meta because the story within the story, you were using metaphor and analogy. And it created really clear imagery in my head. Do you remember when you were a kid and the phone used to ring and your mom would hang up? Like that is, everybody can put an image to that. Everybody over maybe 35 remembers that. How have you built your ability to tell stories that connect and create imagery in other people? Are you sitting down with your presentations and saying like, okay, what are the stories? Are you collecting stories somehow? Like, how did you build that skill?
That's such an interesting question. And it's kind of a combination, O'Brien, of a few of the things that you suggested, which is storytelling goes back to everything we've talked about all day. It's a learned and trained for skill. And my brain these days thinks in terms of stories. So something will happen to me with my kids. Something will happen to me at dinner. Something will happen to me on vacation. And I'm like, you know what? That's a great story that really brings this point to life. Or I'll be going through a presentation and I keep coming back to, how do I make this simpler? How do I make people understand it? And I'll try and find a story that links or weaves into something that people, as I said before, can touch, they can feel, they can hold. So much of my brain is, how do I create a story around that? Or how does this story relate to something that I want to talk about or teach or share with somebody? So many things that I do, I chalk it up to the fact that I don't think I'm all that bright. So I need these simple things that people can touch and feel and hold, because that's how I learn and that's how I remember. But we know from the history of mankind, we remember stories more than we remember charts or slides or those types of things. Like you said, you remember that detail about the phone ringing and your mom picking it up. Those are the things. Probably 5 years from now, you might remember that story. You're not going to remember those three words I use: proprietary, primary, and qualitative. You'll remember that story.
Okay, I get that your brain works that way. Has it always worked that way? Like, how did you become the guy who thinks in stories?
I don't think it always worked that way. I think maybe part and parcel of what I do, which is try and teach concepts to people in a compelling and powerful way, has sort of forced me in that direction. And I've worked on it for a long time. So what I advise people when we're talking about this, so we have an entire workshop on storytelling. So we go through the process of it and we talk about big stories. So, hey, what story can I tell that's going to link this whole 45-minute presentation together in one little hook, in a 60-second story? And then we talk about some of the things you just mentioned, those little anecdotes, those 5-10-second things that people can touch and feel and hold. And I love it when people are presenting and they say, well, let me give an example of what I'm talking about. Or here's what I mean by that. To me, those are all elements of storytelling as well, because they're taking a concept, a thought, a theory, and they're dialing it down to something that I can touch and I can feel and I can hold.
Yeah.
So it can be as simple as, it's like that first day of spring when you walk out there and you're wearing shorts in Chicago, it's that kind of feeling, right? So it could be, what was that, 4 seconds long. That's how we're feeling about this project that we're doing. This was a terrible example, Brian, but I'm trying to come up with something.
Yeah.
Or it could be something a little bit longer, like the story I told you about that woman was probably 2 or 3 minutes long. people often say, I don't have enough time. I'm pressed for time. Trust me. Not that the entire thing needs to be storytelling, but those one or two or three stories, every 15 minutes, think about putting one in. Those are the things that people remember. You can't afford not to find time for those things.
Yeah. Even to your point, even just saying this is like, and then coming up with some analogy. I think one of the ahas for me as I was trying to figure out how to use storytelling in my own life, and it's a continued work in progress for me, but it was realizing that you can use these story elements. You don't have to tell the big overarching story the whole time. You can just say, this is like, this reminds me of, or picture this. And it's those little elements that creating an image in somebody's head. And that's really, I think, what we're after here. I listened to a great podcast on metaphor, and they were explaining metaphor is basically just a way to create an image in somebody's head. And I think that's what stories do. I can imagine my mom or dad picking up the phone. Actually, there's a great family story that we have about my grandfather sitting on the couch at Christmas talking about that experience and how he'd be like, do I know you? Bang. And he kept saying bang and hang up the phone. And we talk about that all the time. So I have this really positive image in my head.
Sure.
When you tell that story. And I think if we get out of storytelling, quote unquote, storytelling as this overarching hero's journey all the time, which it can be, and it's great. But in just like, can you create an image in somebody's head? Again, what can you touch? What can you feel? What can you smell? Like what those, the senses, how do we elicit senses? So I'm not an expert at that in the way that you are, but it is something that I just try to practice over and over and over again.
And you have to be intentional about it because it's very, I always say, there's a huge difference when you're talking to someone or presenting or whatever. There's a huge difference between disseminating information and bringing something to life. And our job, the way I see a vast majority of the people present, and this is going to sound really weird, the vast majority of people, the way that they present, I often say, why don't you just email the PowerPoint in advance and then say, call me with questions? Because all they're doing is reading what's on a slide or going through it. Your job is to bring it to life. Touch, feel, hold it for that audience. You have a profound role. Don't underestimate your role.
I love that your job is to bring it to life. That's a great distinction. And that, again, we're rolling here. That's the segue into the next question I was going to ask you anyway, which is in corporate America, everybody's trying to be data driven, right? In our decisions, there's all these metrics and charts and graphs, and it can become very boring to sit down and go through. How do we bring this stuff to life? Like, do you have any examples of ways that you've done it or clients have done it where they've taken something that is relatively quantitative, data-driven, and they have brought that to life? They've created some energy and some life within that data.
So here's the scoop on that stuff. And that's a question I get asked a ton because it is important, right? We need the data. They want to see the numbers. Fine. Fair. I'm all about that. I'm not suggesting in any way, shape. But what is the data telling us? Again, is this something where we just send it to them and say, call me with questions? I don't think we want to do that. The other issue that I see, and I'm going to get to something that I think will bring it to life for you, O'Brien. But the other thing that I see is a lot of times people who are really smart, not in any self-aggrandizing way, but want to show that they did the work and they did the research. So they'll say, we looked at 50 different markets across 40 different demographics over the last 30 years. Here, let me take you through every one of those charts.
Yeah.
As opposed to, we looked at 50 different markets across 40 different demographics across 30 different years, and that's in the appendix. But you know, three things jumped out at us as our main takeaways, and that's the three charts I want to take you through right now. Now, if someone says, well, what were you doing in Topeka in 1989? Say, I've got that. I'll show it to you. Let's look at it in the appendix. But we need to speak in headlines and highlights. People want headlines, highlights, conclusions, and implications. They don't just want a data dump. And when we have complicated data, what we're trying to think is, what's the story behind it? What is the purpose of us presenting this? And when it comes to storytelling in this regard, O'Brien, or any regard, I always say, start at the end. What's the one thing you want them to walk out with? What's the one thing you want him to remember? What's the one main point that's incredibly salient? Build your stories around that. And I'll give an example. I was working with someone a couple of years ago, and they worked for a global healthcare company. And what they were trying to show is that the world is a very different place when it comes to medical conditions, awareness, and treatment. And they had reams and reams of data that showed what life expectancies were, and based on different conditions, different, let's say, conditions in all these different markets. But at the end of the day, their story was, it's very different. So we started the presentation off this way. And he said, I want to tell you about two people, Joe and Jose. Joe lives in Boston. Joe's a mason. He's a bricklayer. He is a little bit overweight. He's married. He's got two kids who are grown and out of the house. He sees his doctor once a year, and realizing that he was a little overweight, his doctor ran a couple tests and saw that he had high blood pressure. So because of the high blood pressure, he prescribed some medication. Joe's doing just fine. Jose is 55. He lives in Lima, Peru. He's a bricklayer. He's a mason. He's got two kids that are grown and out of the house. He's a little bit overweight. But he doesn't see his doctor as much because it's not as prevalent there. And there's not as much awareness on what some of these medications are. So he's living with his high blood pressure. Jose is going to likely die before he turns 65. Joe has a great chance to live to 80. Is that fair? Right? So we personified the numbers.
Yeah.
Now, that was, I don't know how long that was, 60 seconds. But then he went in and showed the data. So what he did is established a story, a meaningful, in this case, emotional or poignant story around the numbers. And that's, in essence, what we're trying to do when we present.
Yeah.
Now, you're not going to always have that in every single chart that you ever present. But this was a really important presentation to 1,000 people at an annual conference. So he wanted to bring it to life for them.
Yeah.
If you're presenting your weekly update numbers, you're going to be like, let me take you on a tale, right? It's weekly update numbers.
Yeah.
So I tell people, think about, start with the 2, the 3, the 4, the 6 biggest presentations you're giving each year and try and incorporate some storytelling into that. And then you'll see it becomes much more fluid and natural for some of the other things you do.
Yeah. One of the things that I think about and try to coach our teams on too is, the brain only has so much glucose that it can burn, right, before it needs to recharge itself. And it's just like a physical part of who we all are. And I break it down into, there are two different things that a brain is doing when you put a presentation in front of it. It is trying to figure out what that is saying, and then what that means and what it needs to do about it. And they're two different parts. And if we are bogging that brain down with trying to figure out what the presentation is saying, they can't spend any time thinking about what they need to do with it. They can't be strategic with their business or how they make decisions. And so the simpler you make it, if you can just tell that story, hey, we've got John over here and Juan over here, and here's their scenarios. This guy's going to die before this guy. Is that fair? And people go, God, that's not fair. That's what we're talking about. Here's what do we do about
it? Yeah.
Let's talk about what we do about it, what our options are. And then people can get in there and they can be strategic, and versus having people just like, okay, and so this data, and then this is saying something different over here. And so what does that mean? And now you're fried. Like, we would get to the end of presentations where we did this poorly, and you'd be like, okay, now let's be strategic. And you can just see it in their eyes. They're like, we're burned out. We got nothing left. And like, I think everybody's felt that who's sat through a long, tedious presentation. You can't be strategic at the end of that. And so that's sort of how I interpret a lot of what you're saying as far as bringing it to life, or the benefit of bringing it to life, is now we've got all this juice that we can put into figuring out what we do with that story.
Yeah, the fact of the matter is half of what, at least half, maybe more of what you're doing up here, O'Brien, is you have to engage them. I mean, how many times have you listened to a presentation where the presenter was boring and there was a ton on their slides and you just zoned out?
Yeah.
Right? If it's virtual, you're definitely playing connections or spelling bee. And We are in a constant fight and a battle every time we present, and we are fighting against Candy Crush, and we are fighting against email, and we're fighting against ESPN. And if we don't win that battle, we lose the presentation.
Yeah.
Because no one's going to focus on what you're saying.
Amen. We have talked a lot about presenting and storytelling and presence. Is there anything we haven't covered? Is there any other messages or insights you want to share with folks?
I want to build off that last point I just said, and that is this. There's been study after study after study, and depending on which one you look at, it kind of nets out this way. When someone is presenting, you understand what they're saying based on the words coming out of their mouth, their body language, and the tone of their voice. And that adds up to 100%. Pretty much every study that's ever been done shows that 10% or less are the words, and 90% are tone and body language. And when we write a presentation, most of us spend 100% of the time on the words, and we do not think for 1 second how we're going to deliver those words. Practice, rehearse, say it out loud. When I'm giving an important presentation, I will practice it out loud 5 times. And ideally, one of those is a dress rehearsal if it's really important. Saying it in our head is profoundly different from saying the words out loud. Record yourself doing it. But remember, tone and body language are deeply important. That's why you have to be the best possible you. That's why I like it when you stand up. That's why I like it when you have great eye contact, use hand gestures, and have that passion, excitement, and smile on your face.
Yeah. And for people who are listening to this who go, man, that just sounds like a lot of work. It is.
It is.
And especially in the beginning. And that's okay. It's supposed to be a lot of work, right? Like, you don't get to be an amazing speaker. You don't get ranked number one out of 200 speakers at the SHRM conference the way that you have without putting in a lot of work. And so I just always think that's another lesson that's come out of this podcast is people who want to be good at what they do have to put in the work. And if we are just running full speed all the time above max capacity, we don't have the ability to slow down and do the work in any one area that we have to do it. And that's, I mean, I'm guilty of that too, but I try to remind others too, like we have to slow down and put in the work and really think, okay, let's think about the content. Let's think about the stories we're going to tell. Let's think about our tone. Let's think about the body language. Let's think about how we're going to pass this around the room if we're doing a group presentation. Like, you have to plan this stuff. And then the more you do it, the easier it'll become. But it is a big lift at the beginning. But that's not to discourage people. It's just part of the game. To be great takes work. It's Jerry Seinfeld has a great quote, "It's supposed to be hard."
Yeah.
You know, it would be weird if it wasn't hard to be good.
Right. And that's the thing, you know, people spend months working on a project, coming up with some ideas, doing the research, but they don't spend more than an hour thinking about how they're going to present it.
Yeah.
And I always say this to people as I kick off this workshop. I said, have you ever had an idea? Have you ever had a thought? Have you ever tried to sell something that in your mind was a beautiful, creative, strategic, the perfect solution? And then your audience didn't buy it. And they're like, all the time. And I said, it's not because the idea wasn't good. It likely is you didn't do a good enough job trying to sell it and trying to present it effectively. If I'm not engaged, if I don't believe in you, and if I don't believe what you're saying, I'm gone. You've lost me. I work with some creative people at advertising agencies, and I say you should spend as much time thinking about how you're going to sell your ad as you did creating that ad. Because you have to take them on a journey so that they reach the same beautiful, creative, strategic solution that you came up to.
I love
that. And it's hard. It takes a lot of work.
Yeah. Brad, this has been really insightful conversation. I'm going to spread this around our office at the very least and make sure that everybody on my team listens to this because it's so relevant to what we do. And you don't have to be standing on stage in front of 10,000 people at the SHRM conference to be putting this stuff into practice. So thank you for coming on and spreading the good word. And where can people find you and JB Training Solutions if they want more of this in their lives?
Cool. Thanks for asking. So yeah, we, jbtrainingsolutions.com. I'm bkarsh at jbtrainingsolutions.com. I'm also on LinkedIn very actively. and all the other social media stuff, you can find JB Training Solutions. But thanks for having me on, O'Brien. This was great. Had a lot of fun. As you can tell, I'm kind of passionate about this topic. So it was a ton of fun for me.
Well, I think we got the best Brad Karsh today. So thank you.
Yeah. I did have two glasses of wine. I know it's about 9:30 in the morning, but yeah, I have to.
Whatever works for you, right? Can't disrupt the process. No. All right. Well, everybody listening, thank you. And best of luck putting this into practice.
Hey, folks, one last thing before you go. If you enjoyed the episode, make sure to hit subscribe so you can stay up to date with future guests. That's it. Thanks for coming. Go make the most of your business and the people in it.